My parents were both of Polish families. My father was born in Poland. My mother's family had emigrated from Poland to Germany but remained Polish citizens. And my father himself, as a young man, emigrated from Poland to Germany. It was there that my parents met. And after their marriage, they settled in Germany, but they were Polish citizens. So when I was born in Leipzig, I was legally a Polish citizen, although born in Germany. Now, this was before the Nazis came to power. They came to power when I was a very small boy. And so my earliest memories are those of living in Germany under the Nazis. Well, for a number of years, there were various restrictions, there were various things that made life difficult, but of course the Nazis had not as yet reached the full horror of their regime, insofar as it touched most of us. When I went to school at the age of six, which is the normal school starting age on the continent, I went to my local school. My father had died by this time, so but of course I still had my mother, and I went, just as I say, to the local school, where there was quite a lot of bullying because I was Jewish. The boys, after all, were being indoctrinated with Nazi propaganda. I was not actively ill-treated by my teacher, although of course he had to teach the Nazi propaganda in addition to the normal educational material. And this went on for 2 years, and then all Jews were informed that they could, that Jewish children could no longer go to non-Jewish schools. So I had to leave that school and go to a Jewish school, which had, which was in another part of the town. It had existed already. The reason why I hadn't attended it was because it was far away from where I lived. But now it had to take children from all over the city, and presumably also from some of the surrounding places. I don't know about that, but I presume that. So it was very overcrowded. And also there was very much of a spirit of anxiety among both the pupils and the teachers. We all knew that things were going to get worse, and we all had evil forebodings as to dreadful things that were likely to happen, although no one knew actually what would happen. But some dreadful things, of course, already were happening. There were people being put into concentration camps and so on, and we all had this feeling that it was only a question of time before something of the sort happened to the rest of us. So it was a very anxious sort of atmosphere that pervaded the whole school, and I must say that in the 6 months that I was at that school, I learned very little, simply because of that and because of the overcrowding and general lack of amenities of a school that had suddenly had to take a very much larger number of pupils. Well, when I'd been there for about 6 months, I acquired one of these slight illnesses that children tend to pick up at school, sore throat, that sort of thing, and I was away for a few days, and I would normally have gone back after a few days. But whilst I was away for these few days, very early one morning, we were all lying in our beds, and the Nazis came in and told us that we were all being taken away. My own family, and also a family to whom we had sublet part of our flat after my father's death, so that we could have some source of income, of course. They were also Polish Jews, And so we were all taken away. We were not told officially where we were going. But for the moment, we were taken to a local police station just a few streets away. And we waited there, not knowing quite what was going to happen. And then a bus came along. It already had some people whom it had collected from other parts of the city. And then we were put onto this bus and we were taken to the railway station. At the railway station, we joined what to me looked like an enormous crowd of people. It's difficult to know how many, because when you're a child, everything seems very much larger. I think it was pretty large, but probably not quite as large as it seemed to me. And also, there was something different about the station. Normally, at a railway station, well, in those days, you would expect to see the occasional policeman or something like that. Well, in fact, one saw here not only many policemen, but also many SS men, the SS being, of course, one of the main Nazi organizations. But there was a difference with those as well, which I noticed. The German police, like the police in most countries, of course, normally carried revolvers as part of their normal everyday equipment, but on this occasion they were actually carrying rifles. We were put onto a special train, especially chartered for us, and eventually, round about 11 o'clock in the morning, the train departed. Now, we travelled and the train stopped at another station and other people were put onto the train. And somebody, one of the other people on the train, came into our compartment, because in those days trains were divided into compartments. He said, "Do you realize we're locked in?" The doors had not only been closed, they'd been locked from the outside. Well, out of mere curiosity, some people tried the doors. Immediately, one of the doors opened and a policeman came in and told us, if we tried to escape, as he put it, use would be made of the firearms. He said it in German, of course, but that was the form of words that he used. So after that, we didn't try the doors. None of us was trying to escape. We knew that there was no prospect of our getting away with that. We had simply tried the doors out of curiosity. Anyway, the train had no kind of facilities. The toilets had been locked, so that nobody could hide in there. But anyway, we travelled, and those people who knew their geography realized from the names of stations that we passed that we were going eastwards. But that was as much as we knew. Well, eventually, the train stopped at a small station. By this time, it was dark, and we were ordered off the train. And I remember noticing, because as a child, you don't notice the same things as an adult, but you do notice things that adults wouldn't notice. I remember noticing the station clock, which said 10 minutes to midnight. And to me, this was strange. I'd never been allowed to stay up as late as that before. But anyway, we were taken out of the station, and outside there was a ramp with the handrails on either side. Standing by these handrails were SS men. So we walked between two rows of SS men, and they formed us up into rows with one SS man at each end of each row, and eventually we had to start marching. Now, I think that what must have happened was that, but I can only speculate on this now, that as we moved forward, other prisoners came onto this ramp, it couldn't have accommodated all of us, because by this time there were several train loads from different parts of Germany. And we marched. We were very quickly outside this very small town, and we marched into a forest. And we still we were told that we must keep absolutely quiet. I presume this was simply so that if any orders were issued, they could be heard, but that's not what we were told. We were told we must be quiet, otherwise we disturbed people sleeping. Well, it's a bit difficult to imagine that, but that's the way it was put to us. But of course, people whispered to one another, and the rumor went that we were all being taken to a place where we were going to be shot. As you can see, that wasn't true. But I don't know whether that was simply a rumor started by somebody who was scared, as we all were, or whether it was deliberately started in order to frighten us. I don't know about that. But at any rate, as we marched, of course, this was very difficult for some people, because we were people of all ages, from babies right up to very old people. There were sick people. We were lucky we had been taken out of our home, but there were people who had been taken out of hospital beds. And again, we were lucky that we had been taken early in the morning when we were all still at home. I found out later, with some of the families, they had been taken out of their homes later in the morning when husbands had gone to work. Wives didn't go out to work in those days, but husbands had gone to work, children had gone to school. They had simply been taken separately, you see, and had no idea whether they would ever see one another again. But anyway, that had not happened to us. But there were people who collapsed, being unable to walk further. There were people who were beaten, and so on. And there were, as I discovered later, there were people who died on this march. I have heard a number, but I have no idea whether it's true or not. The number I'd heard was that about 400 died, but I have no way of saying whether this is true, of knowing whether this is true. And as I again found out, we were not the only group. There were other marches going on as well. So I wouldn't like to be sure of any numbers that are quoted. But eventually, we were stopped by a railway line. And we were told, this is where we go on alone. The SS men stay there. And we must walk between the rails, because on either side of the railway line there were ditches. If we attempted to walk in the dark, we would fall into ditches. Well, we were told there wouldn't be any train. Now, this turned out to be true. I don't know whether there simply wasn't a train scheduled or whether it was a disused railway line even, but at any rate, there were no trains, so we were able to walk. The only thing is that walking between the rails of a railway line in the dark is actually surprisingly difficult. You've got the sleepers, which you can't see properly. You've got the what they call the ballast, this sort of gravel-like material between them. And, of course, if people fell, they were in danger of being trampled, because you can't stop a large number of people walking when somebody falls. The momentum just doesn't cease. So there were injuries of that sort. We walked between the rails, and then on to our left, we saw some lights. And so that seemed to be some kind of civilization. We made our way towards that. Nobody told us to, but it seemed a sensible thing to do. We found ourselves walking over a ploughed field. Again, difficult in the dark. And I'm sorry to say, I don't think the farmer will have been very pleased when he saw the damage, but what else could we do? And we walked towards these lights, which were in fact from a farmhouse, an isolated farm. And when we all arrived, the occupants of this farmhouse were terrified and locked themselves in. They didn't know what was happening, which I can't blame them for that. Anyway, we just waited there, and what had actually happened was that at this point where the SS men did not go any further, that was probably the frontier. We were in Poland. But of course, we waited, and when dawn came, police and soldiers came, Polish police and Polish soldiers, and of course, technically, we were in the country illegally. We had crossed at an unauthorized point. We had not gone through immigration and customs and so on. Of course, we'd had no choice in that matter. We would have preferred to obey the law if we'd had any choice in the matter, but we hadn't. But of course, they wouldn't accept that. So we were all eventually taken away, and we found ourselves in a little place which, as I later discovered, was called Zbonshin. Now, in theory, we were supposed to stay there, and the Polish authorities wanted to force us back into Germany, but the Germans were ready for that, so they weren't able to do that with us, but they didn't want us. For one thing, the Polish authorities were themselves very anti-Semitic, and they didn't welcome the ingress of Jews, and they certainly didn't welcome Jews who'd come by that route. So we were, strictly speaking, in the country illegally. We had had no say in that matter, and we were there in Zbonshin. Well, everything was so disorganized with all this happening so suddenly that although many people had to stay in Zbonshin, we managed to get away, and we managed to get to Kraków, where we had relations. Now, our relations lived in that part of Kraków which was called Kazimierz. It was the original Jewish quarter of Kraków, because at one time, of course, Jews had only been allowed to live in certain quarters of towns. By the time we were in Poland, the law permitted Jews to live elsewhere, but the Orthodox Jews all remained in Kazimierz. And when I say Orthodox, some people would call them ultra-Orthodox. They were the very strictly Orthodox, the Hasidim. And they lived in a self-imposed poverty. They were not interested in material wealth. Somebody in each family had to earn a living for the family, but the rest devoted their life to religious study and religious observance. It was a way of life that I had not seen before on such a scale. Although my grandparents were Hasidim, nevertheless, they had not lived in a Hasidic community. I should say when I say grandparents, I mean my mother's parents. They lived in France, and we had visited them. So although they kept up Hasidic way of life, nevertheless, they were not in this level of poverty, because they had children, my uncles and aunts, who supported them. But I saw now this Hasidic lifestyle, and the people living in a state of poverty, which I had not seen in Germany, but nevertheless, we we arrived, and of course they took us in and were good to us. But it was very obvious that we couldn't stay in Poland. For one thing, the Polish authorities regarded us as being illegal immigrants. For another thing, to us on the continent, it was obvious that Poland was going to be invaded. I was later to find out that in Britain there were still optimists who thought that peace could be maintained, but nobody, well, certainly nobody in the Jewish community on the continent, and I think very few, if any, people outside the Jewish community believed that that could happen. We all realized Poland was next on the list. And, of course, our treatment by the SS removed all doubts that something would happen, something terrible would happen to the Jews. Of course, we were not to know that it was going to happen on such a scale. We were not to know that technology would be used in that way, but we all knew that something dreadful was going to happen. Now, we immediately tried to get away, but of course this was terribly difficult. Where were we supposed to go? See, no country would want to admit us. Well, in the meantime, things had happened elsewhere. You probably know that a few days after we had gone to Poland, there was the infamous Kristallnacht in Germany. And one of the things that that did was to draw the attention of the world to what was going on. Most people, whilst being dimly aware that unfavorable things were happening to Jews in Germany, most people outside Germany really hadn't taken a lot of notice. And I must say, frankly, that the same is true at the present time in some parts of the world. We all know dreadful things happen, but most of us read the papers and then get on with our daily tasks. We don't spend all day thinking about it. And this was, of course, the way other people reacted. I can't really blame them. We're all guilty of this to some extent. Now, the Kristallnacht, with its spectacular destruction of property, drew people's attention to it. It was more spectacular. And in various countries, people began to lobby governments, saying, we know you have a bad unemployment problem. All countries had that at that time. We know you don't want to admit large numbers of refugees and so add to your unemployment problem. But will you at least take in some of the children to save them? They won't add to the unemployment problem, and it will save their lives. Well, a few governments agreed. Unfortunately, they included the governments of countries such as France and Holland, which were eventually going to be occupied by the Germans, so that the children who went there fell into German hands again. But a few children were saved in Switzerland, and one country which took children was, of course, this country, Britain. The British government said that it would admit children provided that no part of the cost or the organizational burden fell on the taxpayer, provided that either individuals or charities were prepared to meet the cost, and provided that some, either private individuals or private organizations, were prepared to organize it, children could come. It's not quite clear to me whether they set a limit on numbers or whether the numbers limited themselves by the outbreak of war. But in the event, just under 10,000 children came before the war began, and of course that put an end to all travel. Well, most of the so-called Kindertransporter came from Germany or from Austria. There were a certain number from Czechoslovakia and a few from Poland. But the ones from Poland were all limited to children in the same position as I was, namely those who had been forced into Poland from Germany. They were not for children who had lived in Poland all their lives. And eventually I was given a place on a Kindertransport. On my Kindertransport, there were, as far as I remember, 21 children. The Kindertransporter from Germany or Austria were very much larger, usually 100 to 120. I'm not sure whether mine was of a typical size from Poland, but at any rate, it was the one on my own Kindertransport. And so I was eventually to get to England. Before that happened, however, after having stayed in Kraków for a number of months, I left Kraków and we went to a small village called Brzesko, where we had some other relations who, of course, also were Hasidic Jews living in the Hasidic lifestyle, except, of course, that in a village, people were usually even poorer than in a town. So I saw the Hasidic village life for a short time. I think I was there for something like 4 or 5 weeks altogether. And it, again, was another experience. But then one evening, I was told that by an uncle who had been out all day, he came in, he told me that my Kindertransport was ready to go, so that the next day I had to return to Kraków. So I returned to Kraków, and the following day I was, I spent all that day in Kraków. In the evening, I was taken to the railway station, and there I met about 3 or 4 other children who were going from Kraków, and a man who was going to look after us on the night train from Kraków to Warsaw. So we traveled overnight, arrived in Warsaw the next morning, and were taken to what I think must have been some kind of children's home or something. It was a large house. It seemed to be equipped for children, and we spent the day there. There were already some children there, and there were others who arrived from other parts of Poland during the day. And in the evening, we were again taken by, to the railway station, and we traveled overnight to Gdynia. Now, a different man looked after us on that train, but we arrived in Gdynia roughly in the middle of the morning and spent the day in Gdynia, again at some kind of home. I don't know exactly what the home was used for on other occasions, but anyway, we were there. And then in the evening, we boarded a ship, Warszawa, which, as I discovered subsequently, was the ship that took all the Kindertransporter from Poland. And we had to board the ship early, because it was a Friday evening. And of course, the Sabbath began. One is not allowed to board or disembark from a ship on the Sabbath. So we had to board early. Even in those circumstances, one still kept the Sabbath laws. And then there was a Shabbat service on the ship during that evening. And after the service, I went back on deck to have another look at Gdynia, but I couldn't see it because during that service the ship had sailed and we were out of sight of land. And so we spent the next day traveling through the Baltic, and Then the following morning, when I woke up, I looked out of the porthole, and the first thing I saw was land, because we were going through the Kiel Canal. During the night, we had entered through the lock gates, and the Kiel Canal was an international waterway, so even people like us could go through it, as long as, of course, we wouldn't have been allowed to disembark, because it was German territory. But in any case, there was no disembarking because the ship didn't dock anywhere. And we spent the morning travelling through the Kiel Canal, and sometime round about, I suppose it must have been the early afternoon, I can't remember exactly when, we went through the other lock gates, and it looked to me as if we were going out to the into the open sea. I have this clear mental picture, and much later, checking it up on maps, I began to wonder whether my memory was playing tricks with me, because according to maps, the Kiel Canal, the other end of it, does not go out into the North Sea, it goes into the River Elbe. Well, many, many years later, I had occasion to be at that spot again, and also to travel along the River Elbe in another ship on a completely different matter. And I realize now that my memory was not playing tricks on me. The River Elbe at that point is too wide for people to see across it. So it looks like the open sea, but geographically it is the Elbe, and hence still part of the international waterway. So we could go there as long as we didn't dock anywhere. And then, of course, from the Elbe one goes out into the North Sea, but the way we were going, of course, it wasn't obvious which was the river and which was the sea. It all looked like the sea. And I spent the rest of the day in the North Sea, and the following day in the North Sea, but during the afternoon we began to see the coast of what I now realize was East Anglia. So far as I was concerned, it was England. I didn't know the geography of England as clearly as that, but it must have been East Anglia. And in the evening, we docked, or at least we didn't dock, we anchored in the estuary of the Thames and waited for a pilot to come on board and take us up the Thames. Following morning, we were in the Pool of London by the Tower Bridge. We had docked. And a man came on board to look after us kinder transport children, because there had been nobody supervising us on the ship. We had been completely alone. I understood a man was supposed to have supervised us, but because of some hitch he couldn't come, and no one else could be found to replace him. So now an Englishman came along to look after us. There was only one slight problem. He only spoke English. So he couldn't communicate with us. We couldn't communicate with him. None of us spoke English. Well, I suppose some of the older children may have managed a few words, but nothing more than that. But anyway, somehow or other, we were disembarked from the ship, and the different children went to the different places. I was one of those who went straight to a foster home. Some children went to various homes. Originally, the government had not stipulated whether children were to go to foster homes or to children's homes, as long as the British taxpayer didn't have to pay for it. Later on, they made a stipulation, as I've subsequently found out, that they would only accept children for whom foster homes had been found. I've never been officially told the reason for this, but I think I can guess. With war in the offing, they thought that the children's homes would be needed for evacuees. But that's my guess. I think it is likely to be a correct one. Now, I met there at the docks the person who was to be my foster mother and her sister. Foster fathers, of course, were at work in those days, so there was no possibility of their meeting children, but my foster mother, who had come with her sister, and I discovered that my foster mother was very, very deaf. That was why her sister had come as well. So even if I could have spoken English, I couldn't have spoken much to her. Later on, when I learned to speak English, I could communicate with her up to a point by shouting very loudly, but she was very deaf. So I was picked up at the docks and taken into London, and eventually taken on an afternoon train to Coventry, which was to be my home. And at Coventry station, I was met by my foster father. He had finished work for the day and he came to meet me, and I was taken to their home. Now, that really began a completely different chapter in my life. The date when I arrived in Britain was the 18th of July, so it was about 6 weeks before the beginning of the war. Strangely enough, the first time I heard a bomb exploded in anger was before the war began, because one particular day I was visiting some neighbors. I was in their house, and there was a very loud bang. Nobody knew what had caused it, and we looked out of the door. There was a tiny little aeroplane flying over. I still have a mental picture, and although I couldn't speak English, I could tell people asking one another, "That's British, isn't it?" The idea that that plane could have come from Germany to bomb us was absolutely ridiculous. It was a small flying club type of plane. It could never have flown that distance. In actual fact, it was an IRA bomb in the middle of the city, in the city center. So, to me, that added a little bit to the frightening nature of the general experience. The war had not started. Ostensibly, we were all safe, but this showed that it wasn't quite as safe as all that. But fortunately, there weren't any more IRA bombs. The war started approximately 6 weeks or so after I came to England. And in the meantime, I had to be put into a school. The law says a child has to go to school. The law didn't say a child has to learn anything at school, but has to go there. So, of course, I went to school. I couldn't follow the lessons, of course, because I couldn't understand the language. And nevertheless, the teachers were very understanding, and I just sat in the classroom. And although I couldn't learn what was being taught, of course, I was gradually picking up words of English and English phrases. When I'd been at the school for probably about a week or possibly a fortnight, I don't know, of that order, something of that order, we were all assembled in the school hall and the headmaster made a speech. I couldn't understand what he was saying, but there was one word that he kept using, and every time he used it, it produced a strong reaction among the boys. I should say, of course, that in those days, boys and girls were usually educated in different schools, so this was a boys' school. And I didn't know what the word meant, but I remembered its sound. The word was holiday. The school was about to break up for its summer holiday, of course. Hence the strong reaction among the boys every time he used that word. And we was eventually, it was conveyed to me that after that there would be no more school for a time because it was the summer holiday. Well, the summer holiday, as I eventually discovered, was supposed to be for 4 weeks. But during those 4 weeks, the war began. Now, everybody guessed, one could almost say everybody knew, that once war began, there would be bombing. Nobody knew exactly what it would consist of. Would a few planes come over and drop half a dozen bombs, or would huge air armadas come over and devastate whole cities? Nobody knew. One had to prepare for the worst possible scenario. So the authorities, first of all, would not allow any schools to restart until they had improvised air raid shelters. Also, since the existing ambulance system would be totally incapable of handling a situation in which there might be hundreds of, or if even thousands of casualties, nobody knew just what was going to happen, the authorities requisitioned a large number of lorries and fitted them up as makeshift ambulances, but then they had to park them somewhere. And the obvious places were school playgrounds. So part of the school playground was converted into a parking space for ambulances, improvised ambulances, and the school hall was partitioned off with wooden partitions which had gaps in them which were filled with sandbags, and that was to be the air raid shelter, away from windows, because if bombs exploded, glass would shatter and flying glass could cause a lot of casualties. So until all that had been done, we were not allowed to go back to school. And this meant that the holiday was prolonged. To most of the boys, that was just a God-sent opportunity for more play rather than work. But to me, it was also an opportunity to learn a bit of English before going back to school. I played with other children and learned some English that way. I listened to the wireless or radio, in those days one called it wireless, and learned some that way. And I discovered another custom in England that I had not come across on the continent. On the continent, in Germany, a very, very rare treat had been going to a cinema. In Poland, of course, that was completely infeasible for us. We couldn't have afforded that. But in Germany, one went to the cinema perhaps once or twice a year. In this country, one went every week. It was the custom. And in fact, once a week, there was a special performance. Normally, in the cinema program in those days, one had two films plus a newsreel, plus a trailer of films to come the following week, possibly a cartoon or something short to fill in the time. Well, once a week, a special program was laid on with only one feature film, and one paid much less for children, you see. And most parents sent their children that way. It was one way of getting them out from under their feet, I suppose. And, of course, I went to these and learnt quite a lot of English through those. Much of it wasn't the best of English. I had to unlearn quite a lot of it again. But, nevertheless, it was a way of communicating. And, of course, again, I could do that during this prolonged summer holiday. So by the time I went back to school, I had learnt a little English. I could follow a bit from the lessons, not all of it, but a little bit. And I gradually picked up more. The school couldn't have had any preparation for this. Today it's common practice for teachers to meet children whose native language isn't English. In those days, that was almost unheard of. One didn't have children of Asian origin and the like in schools, except possibly in a few places in London, but generally speaking, one could walk the streets, well, for months without seeing a single non-European person. So the school couldn't have had any kind of guidance with this, but they seemed to know instinctively what to do. I was put into a class of boys who were a year younger than I, and I was with them until the Christmas holiday, and then after that I was moved up to children of my own age, and it worked very well. By the time I'd been in this country for 6 months, I could follow a large proportion of the lessons at school. My spoken English probably had quite a few gaps in it still, but nevertheless, I could follow the lessons. And so, in fact, that was done. But in the meantime, of course, the war had started, and to those people who were not actually engaged in fighting the war and didn't have family members engaged in it, the outbreak of war didn't at first make so much difference. One had to carry a gas mask, and one had food rationing and things like that, and various things which one could normally have bought in a shop became either difficult to obtain or completely unobtainable. But daily life continued until the summer of 1940. In the late summer of 1940, of course, bombing of this country began seriously. In a few places, there had been the odd bombing raid earlier. Within the first few weeks of the war, there had been, for example, an attempt to bomb the Forth Bridge in Scotland, and there'd been odd occasions like that, but most of us had experienced nothing of that. But from the late summer of 1940, well, perhaps not so late, actually, from about June 1940, some parts of the country started being bombed. At first, the south, mainly, and then London, and then the provincial cities. And, of course, Coventry was severely bombed. But eventually, of course, the war moved on to its different phases and eventually came to an end. And that is really the story.
So you were brought up in Coventry, Martin. Yes. You're in Leeds now.
Yes.
How?
How? Well, I lived in Coventry until I went to university. And then I moved to Birmingham, which was my university. And although I kept my contacts with Coventry, nevertheless, I spent most of the year in Birmingham, first at the university, later I worked in Birmingham, and later I got a job in Leeds.
Okay, and this is your home now?
This is my home. It has been since 1962.
Definitely. Why do you want people to listen to your story? Why do you tell people the story of your past? Why is it important for them to hear?
Well, my story, of course, is a lot better than many other stories. Many people had much worse experiences than I did. But I think it is important for people to hear about these things so that they will do whatever they can do, whether it's a large contribution or a small one, to try to stop things like that from continuing to happen. Unfortunately, similar things are still happening in various parts of the world, and although we in this country can live peacefully with relative prosperity, of course, there are parts of the world where this is not the case, nor is it by any means certain that it will always be the case here. As you well know, once the Second World War finished, it was followed by the Cold War, which several times threatened to become a Third World War. Fortunately, there wasn't a Third World War, but there were very destructive wars in some parts of the world, and there still are, and one still gets genocide or ethnic cleansing or whatever euphemism people like to apply to it in different parts of the world. I think it is necessary for people to understand how these things can touch the lives of ordinary people. You don't have to be some person of national or international importance to be affected. Ordinary people are affected. And we should strive to stop these things from happening at present and stop them from happening again in the future. It's for that reason that I think it's important for people to understand these things.
Brilliant. That's fantastic. Really, really good.